It's Glenn Mulcahy, your host for Love of the Game Digital Summits podcast and now Facebook Lives. I'm really excited to have an opportunity to talk to our next guest, Dr. David Pierce. He's an associate professor at the School of Health and Health Sciences at Indiana University, affiliated also with Purdue. He's the director of the Sports Innovation Institute, providing high-achieving students the opportunity to work on research products with various partners. In past, included the Indiana Pacers, Indy 11, and others. One of the most recent projects that he did late fall going into early 2020 was a study with almost 19,000 officials across the U.S. We'll touch base on that. And his area of focus is in sports management. He's received awards for Sports Management Educator of the Year, Early Career Outstanding Alumni, and Young Professional of the Year. So I'm really looking forward to this conversation. Thanks for joining us, David.
Thanks, Glenn.
So the first question I ask everybody is, give us a little insight of your story. Where'd you grow up and what'd you play?
Yeah, sure. I grew up on the west side of Indianapolis in Plainfield, Indiana. I played golf in high school. Wasn't good enough to play anything else, but I was the basketball manager for our basketball team, and we won the state championship my senior year, and that kind of gave me an insight into the business and operations side of the sport industry. I also had an interest in broadcasting, so I went down to IU Bloomington, was a part of their sport management degree, did a lot of broadcasting on the student radio station, and then ultimately realized that I wanted to go the academic route and be a professor, so I got all three of my degrees from IU Bloomington and started my career at Ball State University in Muncie, Indiana for 6 years, and now I've been at IUPUI for 7 years in downtown Indianapolis.
So that driver in terms of the management experience is what led you into the sports management side in terms of your area of specialty?
Yeah, so I had an opportunity to teach as a graduate assistant in Bloomington. And in the first week of teaching, realized that I really had a passion for being an educator. And really the only way to do that professionally is to follow through and, you know, get the doctoral degree. And so that was kind of my path into academia, is definitely a passion for teaching and innovation in teaching and the students.
So what truth is there when you're in the academic space, if you don't publish, you perish?
That is right. So you also got to figure out how to do that. And I've kind of figured out how to do that along the way. And now I'm really passionate about using those research skills to solve problems rather than just publish papers.
And that's what led hand in hand. And we'll do the deep dive on the sports, the Institute.
Sports Innovation Institute.
Yeah, because I keep thinking SII. It's like the IUPUI.
Yep. A lot of alphabet soup going on, right?
Yeah, I know. It's then definitely with all the letters after your name, it definitely becomes an interesting way to track people down. So tell us about the SII. What's it all about?
Yeah, so the Sports Innovation Institute was launched 4 years ago, really trying to bridge the gap between academia and the sport industry, with a focus on solving some of the most complex and pressing problems in the industry. And really where we have found success is really doing that with students. So we have gone full bore with design thinking as kind of the central framework that we use and teach in the classroom to get students to understand and identify and frame problems in the industry, and then also use that then as a creative problem solving process to create innovative solutions to those problems. So, had really had an opportunity to teach our senior capstone course for 2 years and kind of, figured out what worked and what didn't work. And then everything kind of came together last fall with our project we did around the national and probably international shortage of sports officials.
And that one ended up being quite large, because the one that I remember coming across that I thought was the largest to date, NASO's about 17,000-ish.
Yep.
And then this one that you've recently done in the fall, carrying into data analysis, just under 19,000.
Yeah, so I actually had two different things going on. I partnered with Officially Human to help them analyze their large data set and create some Tableau graphics and infographics. That was a little bit different than the one we did in the class. So the way we did it in the classroom is we really took kind of an ethnographic or qualitative approach early in the course, where students go out in the field and they observe interactions between parents and officials and other stakeholders and officials. And then I think we did about 40 interviews in the class, and then using kind of the methods and the toolkit within design thinking, We had students synthesize all of that data and then kind of find the big problem spaces that exist in sports officiating that is kind of fueling the different problems with the recruitment and the retention of sports officials.
Yeah, and probably, and I don't know, the numbers are kind of reflective of what I found in Canada. You know, I've been with Hockey Canada as a facilitator now for 10 years, and the trend hasn't really changed where we lose about 50% of our first-year officials right out of the gate, and every year thereafter about 30%. So across Canada, there's on average, like it's like the number doesn't really change. It'll probably change this year because of the way the dynamics going to be with COVID. But 30,000 officials across the country, and we lose 10,000 every year. And it seems like that's the trend that I've had almost every sports group I've seen. And why I actually talked to Brenda for this event, she said similar kind of trends. Is that the case that you came out of your research?
Yeah, it sure was. And so we really focus from thinking of it from the official's journey perspective. So that journey from becoming aware that you can actually be an official all the way through kind of, I guess, making it through that third year. We really focused, or several of our groups in the class, and we've continued to now focus on rookie officials. Those first 2 years, trying to get them over the hump and being comfortable to continue being an official. And so there's so many different problem spaces. I think the thing that gets the most media attention is certainly the parent verbal abuse, and for sure that is a thing. And I know Officially Human and the Hiltons are working extensively and doing great work in that area. I'm excited to hear and be a part of some of those projects and initiatives. But there's also, you know, a lack of education and training. That was a real pain point that we identified, and that there's, you know, there's just a handful of technology platforms out there that officials can access. But so one of our groups really, and we've continued to work on this, was Zoom, a platform based out of Zionsville, Indiana, to really create kind of a motion detection system, to really kind of create a gamified way for rookie officials just to get better, right? So it's taking, we're creating a game software where we're taking point of view, you know, kind of, you know, hat cam or glasses, footage from games. And then you just think of yourself sitting right here in front of, there's my webcam I'm pointing at right here. I've got maybe a play going on. Maybe it's up on my TV screen, but regardless, I can then make motions, you know, different officiating motions that then my webcam can detect and tell me if I'm making the right call. So it's kind of assessing the accuracy and the timeliness of my call. So really the target market there, I think initially with the product we're creating in partnership with Zoom, is really going to be focused at the intramural level, right? So trying to reach kind of the Gen Z crowd, you know, their whole world, especially if you're into sports, is a gamified world. So we're trying to expose them to officiating, but then also train and educate them on the right skills and calls and mechanics through kind of this motion detection technology. So that's one project that I've been extensively working on. I mean, we literally have a student from the informatics program here at IUPUI that is doing his full-time work this summer with the Sports Innovation Institute and Zoom to really create this platform.
Sounds fascinating. I mean, it's almost like they're doing it, well, they're doing it real time, or are they doing it based on recorded games?
It'd be recorded. Yep. It would be recorded, recorded content. And then, so you basically see the call, you would make the motions, the game would tell you, you know, right or wrong. And then the next screen is a trainer that comes on the screen and kind of explains to you, you know, where your eyes should have been, what you should have been looking for. And they just give you a little bit more context behind it. So it was a great partnership with Zoom because they already had a lot of that content from the video content already captured. And a lot of the training content. So we were able to just kind of plug in this new feature into the existing platform. That was kind of our gap, is it was going to be impossible for me to create a whole platform just around that idea, but to now take that and use it as a feature on a platform that already exists, I think is really going to help the Zoom platform and us.
Yeah, I the only thing is, I don't know if Zoom needs any more help.
Well, this is Zoom with three O's, not two O's. So it's a sports officiating platform. So it does it has the same name as the platform we're recording this on.
Yeah.
But this Zoom is Zoom. Yes. Okay. Sorry about that. I should have clarified. I usually say that at the beginning, the first time I say it.
Oh, no, no worries.
So there we go. Thank you for asking that, though.
They went from, I saw in December, about 25 million users, and because of COVID, over 200 million now. So, and I know that one of the things that drives me crazy, and I have to give everybody a heads up when I'm lining up these interviews, because I use my Gmail account, and Google is now putting Google Meeting right at the top of those invites. I've had a few people jump into the Google Meet. I've never used it. But that said, yeah, I get it. They don't want it to be a monopoly. It is the side of it. So it sounds like fascinating work to help on those young officials. And when is that plan to kind of roll out?
So it's moving along nicely. And ideally, the best case scenario would be that campuses are back and ready to have students doing intramural officiating. And in a perfect world, we would be out demoing this product in the fall on college campuses and large rec departments. Yep. So I mentioned the other problem space there is the parent interaction and behavior. So I've got two students right now, based on the work they did last fall, working with the Hiltons at Officially Human to create an engaging certification system, or it'd be an experience that a parent would go through that would kind of expose them to these problem spaces in officiating, do the basic rules, knowledge around whatever sport they've signed their kid up for, and then just basic messaging around seeing the official as a human, right? So when you see someone wearing stripes, they're there to they're the hero, right? Like without them, the game's not going to happen. Instead of looking at them as a villain, how do we see them as a hero? So there's some really, creative stuff going on there. And hopefully, that is something that will be adopted by a wide variety of schools and youth sports leagues across the country here. That is also, just literally in development. I'm sitting on multiple meetings a week trying to figure out how to make that happen and get that out to the public so that it makes a difference.
Yeah, that's probably the biggest challenge for me as a speaker, and it's no live speaking going on right now, but the parent education component. I've had a lot of organizations reach out to me and say, we want to come and speak, provide us some parent education. But the people that come to those meetings, those presentations, are usually the parents that are frustrated with the other parents. And that other parent group, which we call the vocal minority, is like 5%. There's 95% of the parents are amazing. So how are you going to ensure that 5% actually sees this? That's going to be a big challenge. Yes.
Yes, that would be a challenge. It is a challenge. And so it likely comes down to how experience or the program or the product that Officially Human is creating is going to be implemented by the leagues that adopt it. Right. So kind of how that technology works on the tracking side, and if there's any kind of meat, if there's any reward or penalty behind, the completion of it, I think are important things to think through as it's in product development. That's a great point.
So when you're actually undertaking the project, the large one with the spinoff, I'm curious I didn't know about the precursor, call it the personal interview component, the qualitative mm-hmm. side. What was some of the data that came out that was similar to what you heard from the official side en masse, or is there any similarities?
Yeah, I mean, the NASO survey and the Officially Human survey, I would say we basically found the same things in talking to 40 people. But when you really get to hear, we really lean into their stories, right? So as an example of that, we heard stories from referees about how they really were exposed to it at an early age and how that really helped them, make money that they needed for their family as a 13-year-old, as a 14-year-old, as a 15-year-old, ref in two grades or 2 years younger people. So they're 15, they're ref in 13-year-olds. And one group really got excited about that concept, and kind of the third outcome out of the student work that I still continue to have students on and just had a meeting on last week, and this got canceled because of COVID, but we were ready to launch an inner city community with the Brookside Community Development here in Indianapolis in a very poor area of Indy, we were going to have an after-school sports officiating academy. So there was an after-school program structure that already existed, and we were going to plug right into that. And we were going to train students on futsal and also on basketball officiating, because those two sports kind of have a similar game flow, similar rules. You're kind of looking at things the same way. And then we had, you know, immediate next steps. So after they got the training and they got the certification, they got the license, then there was an intentional program and an intentional way for them to take that next step and actually start making money. So one of the things we found in our research was there's a lot of, I think a lot of groups trying to do good by, you know, bringing people in to a, like a 1 day event, right? Bringing kids into a 1 day event, exposing them to the sport. And at the end of it, they get their patch, but their, you know, their certification patch, but there's not always a lot of follow-up on like, well, what do I do now? Right. And then if I go out and I have one bad experience and it sucks, like then people are out, and that's where you see those people quitting after that first year. So we were trying to really be intentional on the mentoring side of it, on the training side of it, and trying to get away from this model where, you know, hey, it's the NCAA Final Four, let's bring in 200 kids, get them a license, and then, you know, send them out on their merry way to officiate. I don't think that's really, you know, maybe the best way to get at it. Unfortunately, that program was canceled, but still working in partnership with Brookside, trying to write some grants to, you know, fund this project into the future. So it's not just a one-off type of project. So that was fun because a student from the fall was able to work on that as their internship in the spring semester at Brookside. And we were really ready to launch that thing, and then, you know, COVID happened and couldn't quite do it. So, what I've really enjoyed as a professor is seeing students continue to work on their ideas, right? So I've got these three projects going on, that, came out of student work in the fall 2019 semester. And here we are in the summer of 2020, and students are still fully engaged in these things. And so that's really at the spirit, quite frankly, of what the Sport Innovation Institute is. You know, it's how do we really give students this creativity bug, right? And really let them pursue their passions and let them look way beyond just, hey, I want a job with the Pacers or the Colts or the Mets or whatever. And all those jobs are great, and we totally train students to do that. But for that, you know, 10 to 15% that have that creativity, have that entrepreneurship and that innovative drive, we're really trying to give them the experience and the toolkit to go out there and make a difference in the industry.
And the amazing thing is you're giving real world experience in lieu of, you know, not the, just the theory that we get out of the university experience. I've done a lot of, we've hired a lot of interns, co-op students over the years that works with us directly behind the scenes. And without that experience, they're never going to get that skill set they need come out of their education. It also gives them a taste of that. Is that really what they want to pursue, right?
Yeah, a lot of the battle is figuring out what you don't want to do. Yeah, that's exactly right.
Yeah, it's like when I, you know, it took me 2 years before I really figured out what I wanted to do post-secondary. But once I figured it out, okay, let's get it done. Let's get out of it. So from the, I guess, the joint survey or the collaboration, was there anything of the data sets that you came across that like surprised you, that you didn't expect it? And or the other side of the can that really confirm what you suspect going into it?
Yeah, I think I'm intrigued around the idea of like access to education. So officials will say in an interview, like, we, you know, we want to get better. We want to thrive. You know, we want to get better at our craft. But when we dug a little deeper and then paired that with the quantitative survey results, what you find is that there's not really a way to do that other than going back out on the court to learn, right? Well, the problem with that for a rookie official is that you're doing that in under fire, so to speak, right? Like if the only way for you to really practice and hone your craft is when you're at your worst at the, I mean, I was an official for 8 years in basketball. I know I was a worse official my first 2 years than I was the seventh and eighth year that I ref, right? So it's just like this negative cycle that takes over where you're getting your reps of practice, you know, at the worst possible time when you're a rookie official, right? So the quantitative results kind of spoke to this like gap really in where I get my reps versus where I want them. I think that that struck me. I didn't realize that there were not a ton of off-court resources and tools. So there's Zoom, RefQuest is out there. You know, there's some different pieces, but they tend to not, but it, when you're the rookie official, you need to be doing more training off the court, right, before you get on. And going to a, you know, let's just be honest, a 24-year-old new official, they're not going to be super pumped to drive 45 minutes to some, you know, officials association meeting and listen to guys share war stories from the past, right? Like, that's kind of the training model that exists within athletic associations. And that just, I can assure you that that's not going to connect with the students I see in my classroom who should be, you know, sport management students and people that love sport and have a passion for it. That should be, you know, where the next crop of officials are coming from. And that's going to be a non-starter for them. So I think everything that we saw around like the education and training piece of it just really spoke to me in terms of like where, you know, where is it best worth my time to step in and try to help.
So that lack of that basically the, even though there are clinics, like even in our world in Canada, though, whether it be a hockey certification for officials or whatever the case may be, it is kind of like a one and done in a sense. You go in, you do your 4 hours, you do 8 hours, then you go out and you're a linesman. The referees don't usually evolve until later on, but you're in essence kind of thrown to the wolves. You're right, because they're not having that opportunity to practice. So I talked to Dr. David Hancock, who is a researcher out of the University of Newfoundland, and shared the same thing. He goes, referees don't have that practice component like the athletes and the coaches do. So what's kind of the solution, the workaround, so that can happen? Out of curiosity, is there any thought on that process?
Yeah, I mean, it's more engagement, better. I mean, Zoom has a lot of really cool. I'm just so excited about learning about all the tools that they have. But yeah, I mean, it's just more practice off the court, and it's leveraging technology. I mean, it really, I think that's going to come along and be the solution. The other piece on the data side of it was, and again, if you follow officiating, you know, but just the all of the different problems and thorny issues that come out of how assigners assign games is a really, really big deal. And so I would encourage everyone, I mean, if you haven't read the book Whistleblower, written by Brendan Zulick, who's the CEO of Silbo, I would highly encourage you to read the book Whistleblower. He really outlines how he believes that really the whole entire ecosystem of youth sports is really threatened by how in some areas officiating assigners assign games to officials. So, it creates a lot of favoritism. It creates some inequitable ways that games are assigned to officials. And in some cases, can just be really detrimental to people wanting to stay in it and feeling like they'll never have a chance to get the games and be able to grow in the profession. So there's a variety of different pieces to it, but Brendan does a great job in the book laying out the problems with assigners and then how he's trying to solve it, you know, with his Silbo platform.
And you think that's partly in terms of personal bias, where some assigners will say have favoritism to a certain group. And then, and one of the things I've heard from a lot of the reason they quit wasn't just because of the abuse they took from parents or coaches, whatever the case may be, is they weren't getting any games. Like, they took it on as they aspiring to be a part-time job, hope they get a game a week or whatever the case may be, maybe get 2 games a week going forward, but like a whole year would come and they might have got 2 as a linesman. Is that part of the problem?
Yep. Yeah, I mean, I think every sport and every area is different, but yes, that is one of the effects of assignment. Obviously there is a role for assigners, but either they need to be, the impact of them needs to be reduced, or there needs to be another way to kind of to do it, where maybe there's more of a, you know, a sign up for the games that you want, which is really what Silva was trying to do, is kind of be the Uber for refs, right? It's trying to put the power in the referee's hand instead of the assigner's hand. So, and a lot of that gets into just community too, right? Like when you get assigned to a game, you don't know the other people that are going to show up. Whereas if you think, at least in Indiana, the way they do high school football, which I think is brilliant, is you actually, you're on that same crew. So every Friday night, you know, the nine guys or seven guys that are going to show up. And so that was another piece of the research that came out, was the, you know, if the officials really value community. So I think, you know, governing bodies and state associations and all the different stakeholders involved here need to be thinking creatively about how do we, you know, create better community for officials, because that community can be the thing that pulls those rookie officials on through into years 3, 4, and 5.
That part of that community is the more senior officials act in essence act as the mentors for the younger ones, especially when they have, you know, conflict resolution issues and mm-hmm. know what to do, how to do it, stuff like that. I know one of the models that's been done in the hockey world is they shadow. So they'll bring a senior official out on the ice. They'll kind of wear a special armband, say, you know, I'm shadowing. The actual referee who's going to be making the calls will follow that referee all over the ice. Kind of like in a restaurant system where you have a training waiter versus a – and they're kind of mentoring in the process. I think that's a great idea if we could do that in all sports. But is it a logistics issue or is it also a shortage issue?
But that's the problem with the shortage then, is you just got to get your games covered, right? So the assigners are not worried about the mentoring and the community. They're worried about getting all their games covered, right? Mm-hmm. So and that becomes the problem. And then you're also asking people to, you know, sticker. I've talked to, you know, folks in Indiana soccer here. I mean, it's that idea that, you know, a referee thinks they're done with the day, but there's still two more games left. And it's like, hey, I need you to cover the semifinal and the championship game too. And that wasn't necessarily on their schedule. And now you've got athletes that are playing what is conceivably the most important game of the weekend, the semifinals and the finals. And you've got a dead tired, dog tired referee going out there. Not that they don't want, they're giving it their best, but you know, when you're tired, you're not at your best, right? And that also is an effect or a consequence of the shortage, right? So it is a vicious negative cycle that takes over.
Yeah, and then the whole fatigue element is no different than players. They're depriving their brains of oxygen, decision making, analysis, all the key criteria of an official is going to be an issue as well. So one I interviewed actually worked with me a couple of years ago. He was an umpire in chief. And he shared a blog and he goes, you know, one of the worst things I wanted to do was make a mistake because that criticism they would take, but the lack of a safe to fail environment. And that's kind of coming back to that, having an opportunity to practice. How can we create that? Like if we started off in possibly the young, like community age groups, say U13, and then they evolve up, is that something that's been looked at?
I think it certainly can be, right? I mean, I think the way I would say it is I would encourage everybody that's listening to this, who's probably got some stake in officiating in some way, I just really would challenge everybody that's in a decision-making role to make this your challenge in your workspace or your organization, is to reimagine the rookie official experience, right? Reimagine the rookie official experience. So use that as kind of your broad, like what I would, in design thinking, we might call that a challenge statement, right? And you can just kind of set that out there as your problem, right? And then you start to brainstorm these different ideas, like just the one that you threw out there, right? That would be what I would love for people to get out of this session right here, is if we can get more people trying to reimagine that experience and empathize with officials going through it, you know, empathizing through talking with them, observing them, you know, all those types of things. I mean, I really think that some of this stuff might be easier than people think. But unfortunately, in sports, we just do things a lot of times because it's the way it's always been done, right? That's the default way of doing it. And, you know, we just don't think outside the box. And so that's really what design thinking ultimately is intended to do, is to get people thinking different. So reimagine that rookie official experience. There's my challenge for everyone. And I would love to hear from people what they come up with if they do that.
I have to figure out how to do a 30-day challenge and just get everybody on the bandwagon. On that note, in terms of, you know, that safe to fail environment, because we're coming out of COVID, we're returning back to training. Do you think the opportunity is right in front of us this fall for this kind of concept to be realized? Because the challenge with most sports is the spectators or lack thereof until we see that new normal going to 2021. Me personally, this would be a great opportunity.
Now's a great time to go out and not get yelled at by the parents that aren't there, right?
You're going to be official. Do it now because, yeah, except there's the safety concerns, right?
Yeah, that's fascinating. That's a great point that I had not thought of till you said that.
Because I know that all the sports groups I've been talking to, if they're going to have spectators, they're going to have social distancing, it'd be a lot less. If they're allowing, it's usually going to be one person per player or whatever the case may be. So it lowers the number of people that are going to be coming to those games when and if they are played in the fall. So it creates more of a, there's going to be less stress for the officials that are getting into space and or maybe second or third year. I see it as an opportunity. I always look at silver line. Yeah. We had a tough go last few months. But what can we do now coming out of this to make the youth sports experience better for all parties concerned? That's the whole point of us on this summit. That an opportunity, and maybe it can be done in pockets. I don't know.
Yeah, and probably wouldn't hurt to think about after COVID's over, how do we continue to create those environments, right? I mean, I think that both on the training side and the shadowing, and then also, where we've got games and tournaments and stuff that are maybe, designed to facilitate those types of environments for officials. So that's good.
How important is the messaging? Because I've had a lot of dialogue on the PSAs and the signage that's out there in terms of the respect element towards these officials. Do you, I don't know if this came out of any of the research or any of the discussions, but do any of the officials feel that is actually working? Or is there other ways that we can help educate the people in the space so that they do respect the officials and recognize they are human? That's why I love what Brenda's doing with her program.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's an all-out approach of branding and signage. And, it's also video. It's also, engagement. Learning some things maybe before you sign your kid up for the league. I think it's radio ads, it's state high school associations working in partnership with, youth sport organizations. I mean, this is one of those times when, people need to not be territorial with their little fiefdoms in sport and really pull together with a common message, pool their resources, get the best creative marketing agency people creating great messaging. And who's working on the Netflix documentary, right? Like Netflix documentaries are powerful. People watch them. Why do I not have a, how important sports officials are documentary or the, a day in the life where here's the sacrifices that people make to come up and out and, ref your kid's game, right? Where's that at? Where's some media program somewhere in the United States at a college somebody call me up. Like, we'll queue that up as a class project for the fall, right? Like, I mean, I think that part of it, it's not any one of those things. I think it's an all of the above strategy. And I really think that the different stakeholder groups in sport need to start working together on this and not just try to tackle it in their own little world.
Yeah, everybody's kind of been doing it in their silo, but an interesting conversation I had yesterday, one of my colleagues is an executive director for a minor hockey association. Because of COVID and the challenges that minor hockey was facing going into the fall, in lieu of them being competitive and by their very nature, not collaborating, not talking to each other, they started doing Zoom calls. So a couple associations, then two more jumped in. Now all of the ones in our lower mainland, we have a collaborative body that they all feed into. There's 37 associations in a part of the Pacific Coast, which I'm part of. And he said, yeah, every week now, 37 representatives from all these things are figuring out how we can make this better. What can we do to adapt, improvise, overcome, going into the fall? Yeah, scales based. They're aspiring to have some 5-on-5 hockey again. It'd be amazing if they also started talking about how can we address our attrition issues with the officials. To me, it's just having a conversation and planting that seed. Agree?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I would encourage folks to, you know, there's some really good tools out there that are what I would call structured brainstorming processes. So we've all been in those environments around, whether we're all sitting around a table or sitting around a Zoom meeting, you know, people talk, but then you're like, well, where did all those ideas go? Right? Like there's a, in design thinking, there's a very structured methodology for facilitating those types of conversations, so that you don't just get the dominant people in the room saying what they think or just having one person make the decision at the end, right? So there are structured collaborative ways to engage in those conversations with kind of follow-up action steps. So I would encourage folks to look into those, or you know hire a facilitator to come in and that maybe isn't as invested. What I've found value in recently is it's not all about being an expert in the content area. It's about knowing how to facilitate those types of conversations. So if people are already meeting, I mean, it is well worth one of the sessions taken out to really just focus on brainstorming. So nothing else about the agenda or the bylaws or new business, just one session really focused on brainstorming and innovation.
Yeah, you nail it on the head, because I've been a facilitator for a long time and coach for even longer. And one of the biggest challenges that we all face as a facilitator is that first hour, say at a weekend clinic, or that first hour of the day. And you kind of have to gauge the room and figure out who is going to try to take control. And there's always the person when you put out, okay, you ask a question, it's always the same person that's like, right? Like, welcome back, Connor. Mr. Connor. Like, okay, I want everybody to have an opportunity. So you have to be creative in terms of how you break them into groups, make sure that everybody takes a turn and da 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 da.
So get the sticky notes out. Get the sticky notes out. You got it. That's exactly right. Get them out.
So the data set itself, I mean, not wanting to go real deep dive, but what I found was fascinating is the crisis component on Officially Human. I just want to get your take on it, because I know this is one from their survey. They said 45% of officials have less than 6 years left in their career. 50% are over 55 years old, so aging population. And the scary one is 12% of officials are under 34.
That tells you all the stats you need to know about that situation. That is pretty dark, isn't it?
It's a crisis, because it's much like in our space, we've been sponsoring students for a number of years. And there's a lot of grant funding out there to do that, because there is a skills shortage everywhere, right? But I'm looking at the officiating thing and I'm going, we're not 5-10 years from now, we already are seeing severe shortages in certain states, like pre-COVID. It's just going to get worse. So what are we doing to get them more into the pipeline? That's the big thing. We need a recruitment strategy now more than ever, so that games can be played, because without the ref, there's no games, right?
Right. Yeah. I mean, and so I think, you know, everything we've talked about today, you know, either directly or indirectly points to retention. So, I mean, it's also, you know, how are we getting into PE classes, right? I mean, we teach sports and physical education classes, and you learn skills of the sport, but how hard is it to just add officiating as a component to that, right? I mean, it's already there. We've already got time carved out. You know, the state governments say you got to spend, you know, this too much time in physical activity. We're already got balls and goals and everybody's doing it, right? I mean it's the one place that one point in time when everybody's going to kind of roll through the same process. So I've had some great conversations with physical education teachers, and you know, it's not a heavy lift to at least at that level, you're just trying to expose kids to the fact that there is an official who is an important part of the game, and that this is something you can do, right? And so that relationship then between the community's physical education teacher and maybe the executive director or the commissioner of the, you know, the youth baseball league or the youth basketball league becomes really important, right? Because that's the pathway. You know, students need a pat on the back, or they just need a, you know, they just need a recommendation, right? Like, I mean, I remember I would never have been a basketball manager if my middle school principal or athletic director in eighth grade wouldn't have come up to me and said, hey, you come to every single one of our basketball games for the boys and the girls. Why don't you think about being a manager when you get into high school? Would never have known it, but it just took the guy saying it one time. And I'm like, oh yeah, that makes perfect sense. Let me go figure that out. Right. So, you know, it, that I don't know how you organize all that, and every community is different, but I mean, I think just people being aware that there's a problem and that there's something small that they can do about it, mm-hmm. which that's as simple as that, right? So I don't want to make it sound simple because it's not, but a lot of this, and what I love with Officially Human and some of the other groups is just, and NASO is like, we're doing better on the awareness side that it's a problem, right? Because if people don't know it's a problem, then you don't even know you're supposed to be looking for something. So I think in the last 3 years, there's clearly been some success in that space. And so now it's, you know, time to take these next steps. So, I'm trying to think of some other stuff that we worked on the recruitment side, but one of them was definitely with kind of the, you know, the high school or physical education, you know, teacher space.
What about on the qualitative side, kind of see how it comes to the quantitative? How many of the officials said the number one reason they became an official is for love of the game? Was that number one?
I don't have stuff up in front of me, but that and give back to the community were, you know, up there at the top.
So top ones.
Yep.
And then high percentage of reason they were quitting was a verbal abuse, verbally?
Yes. I don't have the stuff up in front of me, but I believe I just, yeah.
Yeah, I don't need a firm, just kind of curious, because you're asking them personally, the one-on-ones, which I don't think has ever been done personally. And a data set, you could definitely say.
Oh, yeah, I see what you're saying. No, I see what you're saying. I got you.
Right.
So a great story was that one of the officials that we interviewed was an official for 3 years.
Yeah.
Quit, and then ultimately was stopped out for I think 5 years, but really felt like the number one thing he could do to give back to his community was to be an official, because he was hearing that, you know, games were I think it was in baseball, but literally games are being modified and changed and not happening in the league. So then he kind of stepped back up, got back into it, and now is, you know, one of the top officials in the area, right? So, I mean, that was someone that was severely at risk of stopping out and actually did for a while. The other pretty wild story, and this is where, again, the stories kind of spur the further thinking on things, is we interviewed a guy that the very first game he ever officiated in Indiana high school basketball, which is, you know, high school basketball in Indiana is a pretty big deal.
Hosers and all that stuff. Yeah, I get it.
Was like the number 2 versus number 7 team in the state in the largest class. And he was on a 3-man crew. Now, fortunately for this guy, he had 2 other really good refs that mentored him and actually continued to help him. And he got through that, but you could very easily see where if the first game you ever go do after getting the patch is number 2 versus number 7 in the state, you may never go back, right? I mean, that's just isn't that wild? So, I don't know. I guess those stories sometime are where you really start to dig deeper. And in that one, it was a group started then looking at how are officials, you know, assigned to games and all that kind of stuff. So there's, you know, the percentages are interesting, but so are the stories that kind of undergird them.
Was there any insight from the interviews, not just the parents themselves, but from the abuse that may have taken from coaches? Because I see it kind of on both sides. As a coach, I've seen some coaches go at officials pretty hard, which they need to back off a little bit.
What we heard, so we actually had a really good conversation about this in class, because with coaches, there's almost a theatrical element to it where, you know, they're in some cases they are writing the official because they think there's a bad call, but some of it is kind of the art and the act of coaching, so that, you know, that they need to be perceived a certain way by the parents. Right. And so maybe that's why they're on the official. So officials also talked about that, that kind of nuance is trying to really figure out when is a coach kind of play acting versus when is a coach really going at me as a person, and that, you know, that's just something that you kind of have to pick up as an official. But that's the thing, as a rookie official, if no one's mentoring you through that, yeah, or no one, you haven't trained on, you have no idea, you just think they're always yelling at you, right? So sure. I guess that was kind of an interesting takeaway on coaches, was that play acting versus when are they going at me.
Any insight in terms of what they hate the most? I'm just curious because I've had a bunch of conversations with a bunch of officials. I'm wondering if it's resonating.
That's a great question.
I'll give you one of the ones and see if it came out of any of the officials you talked to.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, go tell me where you're going with it. Yeah.
There's two teams on the ice or two teams on the field. That's like a big pet peeve of almost every official I talk to. And basically the coaches are complaining because they're getting more penalties or assigned to them than the other team. That's a big pet peeve. Another one is get your glasses out. Like it seemed like, really? Like, you know, there's some things I've heard as a coach, and I look at the coach and went, really? Like, seriously? I only had 2 years of officiating way back when, and like many, I just kind of like, I was frustrated wasn't getting games for one, and then also some of the stuff that was going on, but I found the abuse that officials, players now versus, you know, my generation is ramped up like a millionfold because of the high expectations. You gave the 2 versus 7 in Indiana basketball, but think of the hockey community in Canada. Think of some really, really high level sports where parents think their son or daughter is going to potentially go on to NCAA Division 1, made professional. I mean, I think one of the biggest deal breakers that just happened, the NFL with Patrick Mahomes with a $470 million contract.
Yeah.
How many parents do you think are going to try to get their kids to be a quarterback?
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
So, I mean, kind of wrapping up in terms of percentage, it appears that what you got qualitatively is really kind of goes hand in hand with they got quantitatively. So last kind of takeaway is what are next steps? What can we do to kind of buck the trends as we go to the COVID, post-COVID, and then evolve to hopefully games being played down the road?
Yeah, I mean, I guess some of the things we've talked about already, let's really empathize. That's my message is let's empathize with officials. Like, don't just assume they're going to be there, right? I mean, I'm talking to people here that are decision makers and leaders in sport, right? I mean, that's who's on this summit, right? So, you know, let's not kind of play the blame game or just do things, you know, the way they've always been done, or, you know, this is how we get officials, this is how we assign them. Like, I mean, I think training, assigning, mentoring, creating community, all of that stuff can be rethought and reimagined ultimately. And sometimes it's just going out and taking the time like we did. I mean, look at all the creative spaces we got into and we just talked to 40 people, right? So just take the time to really ask the right questions and identify those pain points. And some of the stuff doesn't, I mean, some of these fixes don't even, you know, cost any money, right? I mean, some will, I think if we just, you know, think from that reimagined perspective, it'll be, you know, organizations will get better.
I think the big part is coming out of the box. And like you nailed it early on is that we're doing the same thing over and over again, but you expect different results. What does that mean? It's insanity, Mr. Einstein, right?
Yep.
And that's really the big takeaway I'm trying to do in all of our this and all our prior summits is we need to come out of the box. We can't keep doing this because when you have a 10-year trend, like I've followed it for 10 years, we've lost 50% of our first-year officials and 30% of your – so every 3 years, you're basically starting over. Like how –
It's incredibly inefficient. And then you end up with the stat that you gave there with the how old they are and the, you know, only 12% or under 34. I mean, that's the end result of that trend is that incredibly stark statistic that you read off of.
That 12% is that jumped on me. That got me because I'm like, whoa. I mean, we don't do something now. There's nobody coming in the pipeline. People want competitive sport, and you can't have a competitive game without a referee. It's that simple. Otherwise, it's a great scrimmage, right?
Yep, that's exactly what it is.
So anyway, no, I enjoyed the conversation. Thanks for all the insight. It's always good to get the qualitative, not just the quantitative. It's kind of interesting that they're kind of going hand in hand. And must have been an inspirational experience hearing it from firsthand from these officials that you don't normally get that one-on-one experience with. So kudos to you for taking that on. And it sounds like you got some great things going on with Sport Innovation Institute. And
yeah, we're gonna keep, I mean, like I said, we've got three projects going on. If people are listening to this and want us to jump on something else, just shoot me an email. I mean, I think this is a space that we're gonna continue to work in from an academic side. Like, nobody else is really digging in this way at all. And I mean, we're literally helping three companies or organizations right now create new programming or products. So that's the fun part of the job from my perspective. So if anyone else has got some ideas or want some input or we can help in any way, just contact me.
And that was going to be my last question. So how do people connect with you if they're interested in pursuing that?
Yep. So probably the best way is just on email. So my email is dpierce3. It's dpierce3@iupui.edu.
There you go. Have you got any other social media or website platforms or anything that people can check out?
Yep, sure. So our website is sii.iupui.edu. And then I'm pretty heavy on LinkedIn as well. You can find me at David Pierce.
Perfect. There you go. So anybody that's looking for some more insight and you got some projects that you want to tackle, reach out to David and see where it goes.
Thanks for your time,
David. It was a great chat. You have got some great insight. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Glenn.
Thanks for joining us this week. You can find us on Facebook for Love of the Game, Twitter, TLOTG Conference, and for loveofthegame.ca. We'll see you next week for an all-new episode.